If you go and ask for a discount, they might say no, because we're not convinced you're going to do it. That's where you can then play the rebate card of, well, don't pay us it unless we do it. And I've seen a lot of success from procurement people thinking about things that way and really saying, let's create some win-win scenarios.
Hello and welcome to the Gross Profit Podcast. My name is James Kennedy, CEO at ProcurementExpress.com. We take the hassle out of managing your SMB's purchasing without having to buy an ERP, but we're not here to talk about that today. Instead, we've got Mark Gilham from the second guest, actually, from Enable.com, which is a company that Enable rolling out rebate programs, and we're going to hear a bit more about that. But actually, today we're going to talk about how rebates can go wrong, and you may be doing more damage with your rebate program than benefit, and Mark's going to have some worked examples of that, as well as an interesting background working with high net individuals as well as on the shop floor. So we're going to touch on all of that today. So Mark, you're very welcome to the show. Maybe you could kick us off by telling us something about you that not many people know.
Yeah, sure. A privilege to be here. And thank you so much, James. Something that people don't know about me. I used to live in Jersey, which we'll get to. And one time I actually had drinks with Superman. He wasn't in his outfit. It was Henry Cavill. But yeah, he happened to be visiting Jersey, which is his home or where he was born and bred. And yeah, lovely guy. And yeah, I tell people I once had drinks with Superman.
Very good. And was he just in the local boozer? Is that how it worked in? He walked in a small little place.
There was a big rugby match taking place and he was over there. And yeah, it just happened to be he was walking past, and yeah, I managed to have a quick chat with him, have a drink and get a photo with him.
Did you, because I often wonder, I never seen celebrities for some reason. Did you like awkwardly say, hey, are you Superman, or I love your film, or was he, how did that interaction going?
It was actually quite funny. I was actually talking to one of the rugby players, a professional rugby player, who my wife likes. And I went to him to get a photo with him to send it to my wife. Right. And just as we were about to take the photo, Henry Cavill walked past. And right. He said, oh, do you want Henry in the photo? And Henry just walked in and got into the photo. And I said, hang on a second, would you like to be in my photo? I'd had a couple of beers, so I was being quite cheeky. And yeah, we just ended up having a bit of a chat and things. But yeah, lovely guy.
Very good. Okay, let's follow on from there. Jersey, you were there for a reason. It's famous for tourism and banking, and as you were saying, telling me before the show started. So what was the journey that brought you there in the first place? Doesn't sound like you're from Jersey yourself.
No, I went to Jersey straight out of university. I was working for Barclays Bank in one of their call centers whilst I was at university. And they offered roles for people to go over to Jersey. And I thought, you only live once, let's go and do that. So I spent a few years in banking before then realizing the next step up really would be to go into management of things like trust funds and areas like that. So it was like most people's professional journey. It wasn't something I planned. The next thing I knew, I was managing trust funds, getting my qualifications in that space. And actually that came through my cricketing social world where somebody said, hey, you should come and do this. And it sounded so interesting. The next thing I know, I'm working with a couple of people I know through cricket. And yeah, that the rest was history.
Very good. So trust fund world is interesting. It's an unusual job. Were you, did they call it a trustee? What was your particular role there?
So it very much starts with working with trust funds. And there's different elements of this. But in essence, you take ownership of the kind of the assets. If the rich entity, whether it's a person or a business, no longer owns them, then they can't be taxed on them. So what they do is these assets, basically they place them in a trust. Mm-hmm. So they no longer own them. That trust will generally sit in a low tax jurisdiction, and it will be up to the trustees to do everything that is required with those assets, which could be investments, it could be artwork, it could be property, anything you think that the wealthy might own, there's a good chance it sits in a trust fund. And then the trustees are required to make all decisions on those trust funds, but also to do whatever the trust deed says. So in most common scenarios, pay for children's school fees, look after future generations of the family, these kind of things. So my career when I became qualified was to actually start making those trustee decisions. what should the trust fund be invested in? Should we be buying residential units in London? Is now a good time or not? So you worked with a lot of experts who would give you advice, but it really taught you about keeping your eye on the pennies. Because I was in, even though it sounds like there's lots of money, a lot of these trust funds are asset rich, cash poor. You don't want to be sat on cash. Cash doesn't make money. And I went through that experience right through the financial crisis, when all of a sudden, especially things like commercial property, you had huge issues with occupancy. So units becoming vacant, all of a sudden the rates start, you have to start paying the rates. And yeah, you were monitoring the cash almost daily to work out who can we pay and who can we not pay, recognizing you should always pay the tax man first.
So it sounds like it could be quite a glamorous job if you were buying artwork or investing in barrels of whiskey or commercial property or whatever. Like, what was the lifestyle like? Or was it less glamorous than I am inclined to imagine?
It was less glamorous. There was certainly the odd occasion when things could be quite glamorous. But people would think, okay, so you're looking after the rich and the wealthy, and you picture the people in the press. Quite often, it's not those people. We always used to joke about celebrities were probably one of the types of client you try to avoid, because you want to speak to your client, and celebrities you hardly ever got to speak to, because you need to speak to them to understand how happy are they, what do you want. You don't want to be constantly playing messenger. Also, these people they keep themselves very private, and you respect that as well. So if they're paying you, the last thing they want to see is you living a wonderful, glamorous life, if that makes sense.
And so if I was, let's say, the beneficiary of one of these trust funds, and it's this weird dynamic where you're working for the trust fund, but you have to do what they say. So you're saying they have to pay school fees or whatever, but then do they have opinions and feelings? Let's say if Mark is buying a lot of fancy French artwork in the south of France, and they think you should be investing in SpaceX or whatever. Do those conversations come up?
Yes. And this is there's a huge part of what I class as stakeholder management in this. As a trustee, you're not only managing the assets of the trust, you're managing the relationship with whether it's the settlor, the person who placed the original assets in, the family heads, the beneficiaries, the banks, the investment institutions. You're constantly working with all of these stakeholders. Trustees have some very clear duties in terms of protecting the assets of the trust fund. So you don't generally see high risk investments, those kind of things. And so it's a world that is bound by a lot of law, and there's a lot of tax work going into it, which is again why people tend to be qualified, both dedicated in trusts, but also accountants, lawyers, these kind of people will specialize in that area as well.
And have you ever found yourself in a situation where a beneficiary has sort of, you've come to loggerheads, or what happens in that instance? Because ultimately they can fire you, right? They have the power to fire you?
They have the power to fire you, especially if they collectively come together. Mm-hmm. Albeit, again, there's laws. If you think they're firing you because they want to do something that's not in the best interests of the trust or the other beneficiaries, in a worst case, you could actually apply to the courts and say, look, I don't want this to happen. This is wrong. But yes, I've come to loggerheads. I remember once I was asked by the principal of the family to invest in something called turbo warrants. Now, the name alone, when you're thinking of investments and you hear the word turbo, you think this is probably going to be. And I did all of the research on them, and they were too high risk. And basically, he wanted to bet that the market was going to go down massively during the financial crisis. And the way these things work is, for every 1% they go down, you make a load of money. For every 0.01% they go up, you lose a lot of money. So you're really doubling down on the direction you think it's going to go. And we know a market doesn't go down constantly. It goes down and up a bit, then down and up a bit. And it basically, the strikeout prices where once it hits that number, you're out of the game. You've lost almost the bet. I couldn't invest in that. So again, it's about working out what's possible. And the compromise was, he had some investments in his personal name that I agreed to buy from him to free him some cash, so that he could then go and do the turbo warrants in his own personal estate. So you're always trying to find the compromise, but ultimately you're balancing that, the risk versus your duties and everything like that.
Very interesting. Good, interesting solution there. After this, you were working for Grafton Group, and you have an interesting story about how what appears on the spreadsheet might not necessarily be the same as what you see on the ground floor. But before we get into that, tell us a bit about Grafton and what it is. What type of business is it? What do they do? They're based in the UK.
Yes. So Grafton is a publicly traded company, Grafton Group PLC, and I'd never heard of them before joining. And this was a really bizarre twist in my career. I decided to leave Jersey, leave the world of trust funds. I'm from the north of England. I wasn't that thrilled at the idea of staying and working in, for example, London and having a horrible commute. So I wanted to put my accounting qualifications to real use in what I deemed a proper trading business. And the stars aligned and I found myself at Grafton Group, which is a collection of businesses. So we're probably more familiar with the trading names as opposed to the parent entity. Companies like Plumbase, who they've since sold. In Ireland, you have Chadwick and Woodies. Mm. You've got Leyland, SDM and Selco in the UK and some other brands. Really exciting business, complete deviation from my career path so far. And yeah, it was, from my perspective, it was a real big eye-opener into the world of business.
You were, I guess you were in head office at this stage. It's a group. So there's the corporate Grafton level. You have this sort of publicly traded level, and then you had these sub brands, which were head offices. And then you had the shop floors. Was that the breakdown? And where were you in that?
Yes, you had the parent head office. Then you had its trading brands head offices. Mm. Then you had the actual trading operations themselves. And I sat in the middle. So not responsible for all of Grafton, responsible mostly for the UK side of things going on there in the world of rebates and things like that.
And these are, just for the listeners, what I would call hardware businesses, generally builders, providers, that sort of general sector.
Yeah, very much salt of the earth, what I would deem as working class, you know, straight talking industry of tradespeople who are mirrored by the people who work in the branches of these operations as well, where it's all about knowing your product, knowing what happens. So it's not quite retail. It's retail with a lot of knowledge of the product as well.
Okay. So when you say salt of the earth, and then I hear that you're working in parent organization, head of the dreaded, what they would call the dreaded head office. To build a little drama here, you spotted an opportunity in a spreadsheet in the ivory tower, as they might say it, and then you arrived down on site. This idea was going to transform things for them. So how did things play out? I'm deliberately trying to build drama here, but anyway, let's see. Tell us a bit more.
It certainly did play out. It was, so my role was looking at all things commercial optimization. And this was my first experience and probably my biggest learning event in business. So all of the numbers on the spreadsheets said that our branches could make an extra delivery per vehicle per day. And that was because we ran an operation from 7 in the morning till 5 at night. And at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, these vehicles stopped working. And so the maths all stacked up. And so I went out and I spoke to, and I still remember the gentleman's name, Steve, and explained this opportunity. And I still remember the big smirk and the smile from Steve as he had this little office. And I remember it was up in Scunthorpe. And I remember he didn't even give me the answer. He called in his assistant manager to the office and said, Mark's got a great idea. Mark, tell Neil, my assistant manager, your great idea. And so and at this point, I'm thinking, I'm
set up here.
Yeah. And it almost became a running joke in the branch. And it was a huge learning event. Basically, what I had done is said, okay, so yes, you've got 2 hours spare. There is the potential to make another delivery, but the odds are that vehicle will then be empty overnight rather than being loaded and ready to go. And at 7 o'clock in the morning, rather than it leaving and beating the school traffic, because a lot of these deliveries happen in towns, it will go out probably at 8 o'clock, right in the middle of school traffic, and it's going to lose time. You want to be offloading the product off of the vehicle on the building site during rush hour. You don't want your vehicle on the road if you can avoid it at that time. So what my solution would have done would have been to have the same number of deliveries because everything had just backed up, but actually with unhappy customers because they no longer get their product first thing in the morning, they'd be phoning saying, where is it? We can't start building things until you deliver the materials. And it was a perfect case of what the numbers tell you versus the reality are two different things. And ever since then, I've not shied away from proposing these things to businesses, but rather than saying I have a great idea, more of the numbers tell me this, what am I missing? And that now is something that I just advocate to every accountant, anybody who is supporting a business, even procurement people who potentially don't understand the sell side of the business. Why is it we do these things? So that the numbers only tell us a little bit of the narrative. So really put the two together.
Okay, very good. All right. That's salt of the earth advice there. So let's move on to rebates as a topic and when they go wrong. So let's do some rebates 101 here. What is a rebate?
In the most common term when we're talking about business. So this is not the rebates we think of as consumers. These are the rebates that manufacturers give to their customers, wholesalers, distributors, that kind of thing. Basically business to business rebates. And what these are most commonly are you pay your invoice and you're going to get some money back later on. Normally, it's agreed contractually. It can be for things like if you spend 1 million, we'll give you X percent back, that kind of thing. They do get very weird and very wonderful very quickly when you put two negotiators in a room and they have free will to decide how's our commercial agreement going to look. And so, yeah, it's everything that happens after the invoice price.
Right. So a quick segue here. Is this what Enable helps with, is keeping a document of what's been agreed and tracking what's been agreed in these wonderful, weird and wonderful negotiations?
One thing we overlook at Enable is actually we do the contract management piece, because unless you do that, you can't actually then know all of the terms. So we've often said we are rebate management, but the reality is you create the contracts, negotiate them and agree them with your other party in Enable. So you've got one version of the truth there, an electronic trading contract, which then you put your trading information in and it tells you how much rebate is being earned as well. So it's a way of, one of the biggest issues we see with rebates are disputes at the end of the contract. I think I'm owed X amount and the other party thinks it's a different number.
Right.
The great thing about Enable is both sides can log in, they can see the numbers, you can avoid the disputes.
Okay. Why would you use a rebate versus just a straight up discount? I'll give you a discount, whatever, if you manage to, or just a straight up volume order. So if I want more volume, okay, the price for 100x, it has a 20% discount and we'll just do it that way.
Yeah. So the key for me is there's definitely times when discounts are best and there's definitely times when rebates. And when we hear bad stories, it's probably because we've got them the wrong way around. You're absolutely right. If it's a one-off order and volume is key in that order conversation, then discounting could well be the most appropriate. I like to think of rebates are more about managing the relationship. Discounts are more about managing the order. So rebates, if your customer commits to saying, I'm going to spend 1 million with you, I want a good price, you can do that with as opposed to giving them the money up front and then hoping that they do what they say they're going to do. We did a bit of research with a partner a while back, and we found that 58% of the time, the customer does what they say they're going to do in order to get the discount. I think that's probably no surprise to many. The other side of disc rebates is they create stickiness. If you're paying them out, the way you structure them and things, it's a great reward. And also when you're negotiating, this is huge for procurement. If you go and ask for a discount, they might say no, because we're not convinced you're going to do it. That's where you can then play the rebate card of, well, don't pay us it unless we do it. And I've seen a lot of success from procurement people thinking about things that way and really saying, let's create some win-win scenarios, doing it that way.
Right. Okay. I don't want to say it's a mind trick, but there's a relational aspect to this where there's something about getting to invoice someone and getting cash physically back, which is different to the invisible cash you don't see off a discount. So
and if you think about it, once you've given a discount, it's done and it's easily forgotten. If the customer is trading with you and they, at the end of the year, there's thousands of pounds sat there, it just stays relevant. And so they're a great way to lock in a customer. I would say, given this is a more procurement orientated podcast, I would always say be careful about being locked in by rebates. But at the same time, good rebates you probably want to be locked in because you're earning great money from them. So it is about the right rebate in the right scenario. It is critical.
Okay, so maybe we can just talk us through some, if you're, let's say, designing a rebate plan, what are some of the mistakes that people make that you have seen in the real world?
I think one of them is not being specific enough. So this isn't about being complicated, but if you're going to pay out a rebate, as an example, and you just say to the customer, if you grow your account by 5%, I'll pay you some money. I can almost guarantee you they'll grow it by 5% in probably the areas you did not want them to grow it. Put some guardrails around what growth you actually want. The other one is when rebates get too, you don't want rebates that are too big, because as much as it looks good, it probably means that the discount's not big enough. You've put more into the rebate than needed and it should have moved over to the discount. So then when the sales team are trying to trade on the product, they start to not trust the costs they're seeing and think everything's sat in rebate. I'm going to have to start guessing as to what this product costs me in order to make sales decisions. There's some of the common pitfalls, one size fits all type things. The big one as well is assuming you're going to get growth from your rebate. If you give a customer a really good contract, there's a good chance what they're going to do is they're going to use that contract to go and win business from your other customers, which means as much as their account grows, your net portfolio doesn't, because all they're doing is cannibalizing business. So when you're trying to get growth from a rebate scheme, you want net new growth in most cases. So be mindful of what you're doing. And then I would say on a procurement perspective, don't get sucked into just the rebate. Look at all of the other parts of the agreement. I've seen it many times where a supplier has agreed to give an extra couple of percent as a rebate, and then 2 months later you have a price increase and you're all back to where you were, except you've now just tied up more cash in the contract. So don't, try and cover all bases with these things.
You mentioned as well in a supply chain, if you're part of a supply chain, I guess the first part is here, I can be selling to a particular reseller, but then if they're cannibalizing my other reseller, then no benefit to me, just a benefit, I guess, to the reseller that I'm working with, consolidating my supply. I guess in certain circumstances, consolidating your supply, but then you're increasing your risk with that with them. So it's a trade-off maybe. What if you have what they call a cost plus contractor in your supply chain? How can that damage turn out to be a negative if you're giving to a supplier that who is ultimately operating on a cost plus scenario?
Yeah, I mean, it's such a strong point, this. In a lot of industries, pricing is cost plus. And if you are selling into a business or you are buying, you need to understand how that product is going to be priced by the next part of the supply chain, the next piece of the puzzle. Because if they are cost plus prices and you're in procurement, so you're buying and your sales team are cost plus, there's two elements to that, cost and plus. Sales will control the plus. We're going to stick 20, 30%, whatever it is on this. You control the cost. And you can make that cost go up or down. So as an example, if you've just got an amazing deal, for some reason, maybe you've seen some growth. If you put that saving, this extra saving that you're going to get on this new deal straight into the invoice price, into the cost, your sales team are going to pass it straight out of your business. Not only that, because it's a reduction, it's a big reduction in the sales price. So it actually means pounds, dollars, whatever it is, you're going to make less money. And in a world where payroll doesn't change that way, you do not want to make, payroll isn't about percentages. Payroll's about absolute numbers. So this is about absolute numbers. Your percentages won't change. You'll still be making the same margin, still having the same markup. You'll just have less money. So understand that, because if you get a genuine, for example, 5% saving that the market is not expecting, consider taking it as a rebate. It doesn't have to tie up cash flow either. You can take it as a rebate and claim it as you pay those invoices as well. So it doesn't even have to tie up cash.
Let me see if I got this right. So let's say I'm working with a reseller. I could give them a discount which reduced their cost, and then they're actually making less money, and so are we, because the end consumer is getting something they never asked for. Whereas if I did that as a rebate, the salespeople don't see that rebate, do they? Or they may, it gets complicated, but then the margins remain the same. Yes. Consumer probably gets what they always had. It's a better way of incentivizing people. Have I got that right?
Yeah, and the real fine point here is it has to be credible. If you're sticking a huge amount of money behind in a rebate so that the cost the salespeople see, or the cost whatever pricing mechanism sees, is unrealistic, then the process fails. This is about the market are happy with the price they're paying. The fact that we've done something in the middle of the supply chain to make more money means we want to lock that money into the supply chain. We want to lock that benefit. So that's when you would consider using a rebate.
Okay. So that's the sort of rebate program provider side of it. What are the pitfalls that on the other side of this, if you're becoming reliant on or someone's come to you offering a rebate, what should you be watching out for?
I think understanding the contract is the biggest one. Even though, for example, contracts might say all purchases earn a rebate, it's often that they don't. There's the small print. One of the biggest checks I'd always say is, if let's say you get a 5% rebate, look at your total purchases, look at your total rebate. How close to 5% is that? In some cases, it'll be very close. In others, it will not. Understand what's creating that gap. There's always non-rebatable elements, or generally there is, to a contract. Make sure you understand them, because if your sales team are aware of these rebates, they might be trading thinking there's 5% behind everything when there's not. And I've seen that firsthand. So having that visibility. And then likewise, as I mentioned, on that cost plus mechanism, if you've put 5% behind most things, but then not on others, you'll probably see everything will go out at cost plus 20 or whatever that number is. It just means the bit that you didn't put 5% behind is now lower margin compared to everything else.
Yeah.
And so I would say that. And then do not never negotiate something more complicated than you can actually manage. That is, it's unfortunately too easy for procurement to negotiate a contract and then just hand it to finance, who are going to stick it in a spreadsheet, and it's not going to get looked at very often, and it doesn't actually turn into cash at the end of the year. So I would always say only bill rebates as complicated as your process can handle.
Yeah, and the most obvious pitfall there would be Bob negotiates this rebate, and Bob goes off and retires. 3 years later, you're still operating for some reason, or we get a rebate from these people, and people are like, why? I don't know. And you ask on the other side, and the same things happen there.
One of the worst is when you get a check in the post, which used to happen, for quite a pretty big number, and nobody was expecting it. And you think, this is amazing. But then you think, actually, if they hadn't sent us the check, nobody would have asked for it. Actually, that's not amazing, because how many other checks are we not getting because we're not asking for them?
And how is it generally those rebates managed? Is it, do you invoice back? Do you get a credit note, or how does that manage?
It varies. It really does vary. If you're buying through a buying group, generally they're going to look after these things for you. But if you are buying direct, then you'll get a combination of credit notes, checks in the post. The check in the post was a classic because it takes longer to get the cash. And it's so easy for them to get lost, and they're like, oh, I'll issue another one. Did they issue the first one in the first place? Who knows? Credit notes, cash in the bank, checks, free goods, all sorts of weird and wonderful arrangements. And again, it comes back to each probably has a purpose. Make sure that you align the purpose with actually the requirement.
Very good. All right. This has been fun, Mark. How can people get in touch with you? Just to be clear here. So you work with Enable, but you have a specific function and there's specific people you help, right? So tell us a bit about that. Who should reach out to you and how can they do it?
I would say in terms of Enable provide really two services. One is the software side of things. It's where Enable's really cut its teeth, more on the procurement side. I was a former client of Enable's. So this ranges all the way from SMBs to multinationals, making sure you negotiate the best rebate terms, making sure that they're then documented, collected, but also maximized, making sure you never just miss targets, things like that, so you have that visibility. That's one side of it. The other, which is relatively new, is the area I head up, which is Enable Advisory, which is really teaching people what does good look like and how do you get there? Because software is one piece of the puzzle, but actually there's a whole lot of practice, strategy, and areas like that. And that's where my view is that bad practices in good software generally still lead to bad outcomes. So Enable recognize that, and we're putting the two together. You can contact us at enable.com. You can also find me at mark.gillam@enable.com or on LinkedIn. There's not many Mark Gillams out there. I'm the Enable one.
Okay, great. So let's wrap it up by just asking, who is your business hero and why?
It's really tricky because for me, I have quite a few. For me, it's less about the hero, more what I look for. And one of the reasons we were talking earlier, I love about SMBs, and I've been out to visit lots of them in my career, is businesses that put people first. Any business leader or business that does that, they're my hero. I still believe in that view from, was it Richard Branson? Look after your employees and they'll look after your customers. So I just feel that the way we should do business is people first. And so any business leader that does that is my hero.
Very good. I'm smiling because I remember I read the Richard Branson's autobiography, and there's a story in there about how he ran a record company, and he looked after everyone very well, very famous for that. And then one of the employees found a stack of cash in a drawer, and they realized how much money he was making out of this whole thing. And suddenly the worm turned. They were like, oh, he's not so good. What's he doing with all this money? I don't have this money, but there you go. That's business. Mark, yeah. You've been great. Thanks for coming along, and thank you for listening. If you got this far, your special reward is to be able to go to procurementexpress.com/partners. On there, I have a webinar and it explains my take on how fractional CFOs can best explain their value to CEOs in a way that they would understand, because let's face it, sometimes CEOs are a bit crazy and they have their own set of thinking on the world. So this is my take on how to explain that value. And it's a crying shame. A lot of fractional CFOs do not explain their value properly. It's the most powerful hire you can make in your business, pass a couple of million in revenue, but many people don't realize that. And this is my take on trying to fix that problem. Excuse me. So that's it. I have to sign up for that. And Mark, thanks for coming along to the show.
Thank you so much, James.